"Keep away from me, Sawyer," he says, backing up with his hands held out in front of him. "I have an extremely hungry lawyer. Caveat emperor, you asshole. Lay one finger on me, and he and I will strip you of everything you... Ow, ow!" Wendell has stepped on a piece of broken glass, Jack sees, probably from one of the prints that formerly decorated the walls and are now decorating the floor. He takes one more off-balance lurch backward, this time steps on his own trailing slacks, and goes sprawling into the leather recliner where Dr. Spiegelman presumably sits while quizzing his patients on their troubled childhoods. La Riviere's premier muckraker stares at the approaching Neanderthal with wide, horrified eyes, then throws the minicorder at him. Jack sees that it's covered with scratches. He bats it away. "Rape!" Wendell squeals. "He's raping one of the loonies! He's..." Jack pops him on the point of the chin, pulling the punch just a little at the last moment, delivering it with almost scientific force. Wendell flops back in Dr. Spiegelman's recliner, eyes rolling up, feet twitching as if to some tasty beat that only the semi-conscious can truly appreciate. "The mad Hungarian couldn't have done better," Jack murmurs. It occurs to him that Wendell ought to treat himself to a complete neurological workup in the not-too-distant future. His head is put in a hard couple of days. The door to the hall bursts open. Jack steps in front of the recliner to hide Wendell, stuffing a shirt into his pants. At some point, he zipped his fly, thank God. A candy striper pokes her fluffy head into Dr. Spiegelman's office. Although she's probably 18, her panic makes her look about 12. "Who's yelling in here?" she asks. "Who's hurt?" Jack has no idea what to say, but Judy manages like a pro. "It was a patient," she says. "Mr. Lackley, I think. He came in, yelled that we were all going to be raped, and then ran out again." "You have to leave at once," the candy striper tells them. "Don't listen to that idiot Ethan, and don't use the elevator. We think it was an earthquake." "Right away," Jack says crisply, and although he doesn't move, it's good enough for the candy striper. She heads out. Judy crosses quickly to the door. It closes but won't latch. The frame has been subtly twisted out of true. There was a clock on the wall. Jack looks toward it, but it's fallen face down to the floor. He goes to Judy and takes her by the arms. "How long was I over there?" "Not long," she says. "But what an exit you made. Kapow! Did you get anything?" Her eyes plead with him. "Enough to know I have to go back to French Landing right away," he tells her. "Enough to know that I love you, that I'll always love you in this world or any other." "Tyler, is he alive?" She reverses his grip so she is holding him. Sophie did exactly the same thing in Faraway, Jack remembers. "Is my son alive?" "Yes, and I'm going to get him for you." His eye happens on Spiegelman's desk, which has danced its way into the room and stands with all its drawers open. He sees something interesting in one of those drawers and hurries across the carpet, crunching on broken glass and kicking aside one of the prints. In the top drawer to the left of the desk's knee hole is a tape recorder, considerably bigger than Wendell Green's trusty Panasonic, and a torn piece of brown wrapping paper. Jack snatches up the paper first. Scrawled across the front, in draggling letters he's seen at both Ed's Eats and on his own front porch, is this: "Deliver to Judy Marshall, also known as Sophie." There are what appear to be stamps in the upper corner of the torn sheet. Jack doesn't need to examine them closely to know that they are really cut from sugar packets, and that they were affixed by a dangerous old dodderer named Charles Burnside. But the fisherman's identity no longer matters much, and Speedy knew it. Neither does his location, because Jack has an idea chummy Burnside can flip to a new one pretty much at will. But he can't take the real doorway with him. The doorway to the furnace lands, to Mr. Munshun, to Ty. If Beezer and his pals found that... Jack drops the wrapping paper back into the drawer, hits the eject button on the tape recorder, and pops out the cassette tape inside. He sticks it in his pocket and heads for the door. "Jack?" He looks back at her. Beyond them, fire alarms honk and blat, lunatics scream and laugh. Staff runs to and fro. Their eyes meet. In the clear blue light of Judy's regard, Jack can almost touch that other world with its sweet smells and strange constellations. "Is it wonderful over there? As wonderful as in my dreams?" It's wonderful, he tells her. And you are too. Hang in there, okay? Halfway down the hallway, Jack comes upon a nasty sight. Ethan Evans, the young man who once had Wanda Kinderling as his Sunday school teacher, has laid hold of a disoriented old woman by her fat upper arms and is shaking her back and forth. The old woman's frizzy hair flies around her head. Shut up, young Mr. Evans is shouting at her. Shut up, you crazy old cow! You're not going anywhere except back to your dad-blame room! Something about his sneer makes it obvious that even now, with the world turned upside down, young Mr. Evans is enjoying both his power to command and his Christian duty to brutalize. This is only enough to make Jack angry. What infuriates him is the look of terrified incomprehension on the old woman's face. It makes him think of boys he once lived with long ago, in a place called the Sunlight Home. It makes him think of Wolf. Without pausing or so much as breaking stride, they have entered the endgame phase of the festivities now, and somehow he knows it. Jack drives his fist into young Mr. Evans's temple. That worthy lets go of his plump and squawking victim, strikes the wall, then slides down it, his eyes wide and dazed. Either you didn't listen in Sunday school or Kinderling's wife taught you the wrong lessons, Jack says.
You hit me, young Mr. Evans whispers.
He finishes his slow dive, splay-legged on the hallway floor, halfway between the records annex and ambulatory ophthalmology. Abuse another patient, this one, the one I was just talking to, any of them, and I'll do a lot more than that, Jack promises young Mr. Evans. Then he's down the stairs, taking them two at a time, not noticing a handful of Johnny-clad patients who stare at him with expressions of puzzled, half-fearful wonder. They look at him as if at a vision, who passes them in an envelope of light, some wonder as brilliant as it is mysterious. 10 minutes later, long after Judy Marshall has walked composedly back to her room without professional help of any kind, the alarms cut off. An amplified voice, perhaps even Dr. Spiegelman's own mother wouldn't have recognized it as her boy's, begins to blare from the overhead speakers. At this unexpected roar, patients who had pretty much calmed down begin to shriek and cry all over again. The old woman whose mistreatment so angered Jack Sawyer is crouched below the admissions counter with her hands over her head, muttering something about the Russians and civil defense.
The emergency is over, Spiegelman assures his cast and crew. There is no fire. Please report to the commons room on each floor. This is Dr. Spiegelman, and I repeat that the emergency is over.
Here comes Wendell Green, weaving his way slowly toward the stairwell, rubbing his chin gently with one hand. He sees young Mr. Evans and offers him a helping hand. For a moment, it looks as though Wendell may be pulled over himself, but then young Mr. Evans gets his buttocks against the wall and manages to gain his feet.
The emergency is over. I repeat, the emergency is over. Nurses, orderlies, and doctors, please escort all patients to the common rooms on each floor.
Young Mr. Evans eyes the purple bruise rising on Wendell's chin. Wendell eyes the purple bruise rising on the temple of young Mr. Evans.
Sawyer? Young Mr. Evans asks.
Sawyer, Wendell confirms.
Bastard sucker punched me, young Mr. Evans confides.
Son of a bitch came up behind me, Wendell says. The Marshall woman, he had her down. He lowers his voice. He was getting ready to rape her. Young Mr. Evans' whole manner says he is sorrowful but not surprised.
Something ought to be done, Wendell says.
You got that right.
People ought to be told.
Gradually, the old fire returns to Wendell's eyes. People will be told by him, because that is what he does, by God. He tells people.
Yeah, young Mr. Evans says.
He doesn't care as much as Wendell does. He lacks Wendell's burning commitment. But there's one person he will tell, one person who deserves to be comforted in her lonely hours, who has been left on her own Mount of Olives, one person who will drink up the knowledge of Jack Sawyer's evil like the very waters of life.
This kind of behavior cannot just be swept under the rug, Wendell says.
No way, young Mr. Evans agrees. No way, Jose.
Jack has barely cleared the gates of French County Lutheran when his cell phone tweets.
He thinks of pulling over to take the call, hears the sound of approaching fire engines, and decides for once to risk driving and talking at the same time. He wants to be out of the area before the local fire brigade shows up and slows him down. He flips the little Nokia open. Sawyer.
Where the fuck are you? Beezer St. Pierre bellows. Man, I've been hitting redial so hard I damn near punched it off the phone.
I've been... But there's no way he can finish that. Not and stay within shouting distance of the truth, that is. Or maybe there is. I guess I got into one of those dead zones where the cell phone just doesn't pick up.
Never mind the science lesson, chum. Get your ass over here right now. The actual address is 1 Nail House Row. It's County Road 00 just south of Chase. It's the baby shit brown two-story on the corner.
I can find it, Jack says, and steps down a little harder on the Ram's gas pedal. I'm on my way now.
What's your 20, man?
Still Arden, but I'm rolling. I can be there in maybe half an hour.
Fuck!
There is an alarming crash rattle in Jack's ear as somewhere on Nail House Row, Beezer slams his fist against something. Probably the nearest wall.
The fuck's wrong with you, man? Mouse is going down. I mean fast. We're doing our best, those of us who are still here, but he's going down.
Beezer is panting, and Jack thinks he's trying not to cry. The thought of Armand St. Pierre in that particular state is alarming. Jack looks at the Ram speedometer, sees it's touching 70, and eases off a tad. He won't help anybody by getting himself greased in a road wreck between Arden and Centralia.
What do you mean, those of us who are still here? Never mind, just get your butt down here if you want to talk to Mouse. And he sure wants to talk to you because he keeps saying your name.
Beezer lowers his voice.
When he ain't just raving his ass off, that is. Doc's doing his best, me and Bear Girl too, but we're shoveling shit against the tide here.
Tell him to hold on, Jack says.
Fuck that, man, tell him yourself.
There's a rattling sound in Jack's ear, the faint murmuring of voices. Then another voice, one which hardly sounds human, speaks in his ear.
Gotta hurry. Gotta get over here, man. Thing bit me. I can feel it in there like acid.
Hold on, Mouse, Jack says. His fingers are dead white on the telephone. He wonders that the case doesn't simply crack in his grip. I'll be there fast as I can.
Better be. Others already forgot. Not me.
Mouse chuckles. The sound is ghastly beyond belief, a whiff straight out of an open grave.
I got the memory serum, you know? It's eating me up, eating me alive, but I got it.
There's the rustling sound of the phone changing hands again, then a new voice. A woman's. Jack assumes it's Bear Girl.
You got them moving, she says. You brought it to this. Don't let it be for nothing.
There is a click in his ear. Jack tosses the cell phone under the seat and decides that maybe 70 isn't too fast after all. A few minutes later, they seem like very long minutes to Jack, he's squinting against the glare of the sun on Tamarack Creek. From here he can almost see his house, and Henry's. Henry. Jack thumps the side of his thumb lightly against his breast pocket, and hears the rattle of the cassette tape he took from the machine in Spiegelman's office. There's not much reason to turn it over to Henry now. Given what Potter told him last night and what Mouse is holding on to tell him today, this tape and the 911 tape have been rendered more or less redundant. Besides, he's got to hurry to Nail House Row. There's a train getting ready to leave the station, and Mouse Bauman is very likely going to be on it. And yet, I'm worried about him, Jack says softly. Even a blind man could see I'm worried about Henry. The brilliant summer sun, now sliding down the afternoon side of the sky, reflects off the creek and sends shimmers of light dancing across his face. Each time this light crosses his eyes, they seem to burn. Henry isn't the only one Jack's worried about either. He's got a bad feeling about all of his new French Landing friends and acquaintances, from Dale Gilbertson and Fred Marshall, right down to such bit players as old Steamy McKay, an elderly gent who makes his living shining shoes outside the public library, and Artis Walker, who runs the ramshackle bait shop down by the river. In his imagination, all these people now seem made of glass. If the fisherman decides to sing high C, they'll vibrate and then shatter to powder. Only it's not really the fisherman he's worried about anymore. This is a case, he reminds himself. Even with all the territory's weirdness thrown in, it's still a case, and it's not the first one you've ever been on where everything suddenly started to seem too big. where all the shadows seem to be too long. True enough, but usually that funhouse sense of false perspective fades away once he starts to get a handle on things. This time, it's worse, and worse by far. He knows why, too. The fisherman's long shadow is a thing called Mr. Munshun, an immortal talent scout from some other plane of existence. Nor is even that the end, because Mr. Munshun also casts a shadow. A red one. Abala, Jack mutters. Abala Dune and Mr. Munshun and the crow Gorg. Just three old pals walking together on night's Plutonian shore. For some reason, this makes him think of the walrus and the carpenter from Alice. What was it they took for a walk in the moonlight? Clams? Mussels? Jack's damned if he can remember, although one line surfaces and resonates in his mind, spoken in his mother's voice. The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things. The Abala is presumably hanging out in his court, the part of him that isn't imprisoned in Speedy's dark tower, that is. But the fisherman and Mr. Munshun could be anywhere. Do they know Jack Sawyer has been meddling? Of course they do. By today, that is common knowledge. Might they try to slow him down by doing something nasty to one of his friends? A certain blind sportscaster, headbanger, bebopper, for instance? Yes, indeed. And now, perhaps because he's been sensitized to it, he can once more feel that nasty pulse coming out of the southwestern landscape, the one he sensed when he flipped over for the first time in his adult life. When the road curves southeast, he almost loses it. Then, when the ram points its nose southwest again, the poisonous throb regains strength, beating into his head like the onset of a migraine headache. That's Black House, you feel. Only it's not a house. Not really. It's a wormhole in the apple of existence, leading all the way down into the furnace lands. It's a door. Maybe it was only standing ajar before today, before Beezer and his pals turned up there, but now it's wide open and letting in one hell of a draft. Ty needs to be brought back, yes, but that door needs to be shut as well, before God knows what awful things come snarling through. Jack abruptly swings the ram onto Tamarack Road. The tires scream. His seatbelt locks, and for a moment he thinks the truck may overturn. It stays up, though, and he goes flying toward Norway Valley Road. Mouse will just have to hang on a little bit longer. He's not going to leave Henry way out here on his own. His pal doesn't know it, but he's going on a little field trip to Nail House Row. Until this situation stabilizes, it seems to Jack that the buddy system is very much in order. Which would have been all well and good if Henry had been at home, but he's not. Alvina Morton, dust mop in hand, comes in response to Jack's repeated jabbing at the doorbell. He's been over at KDCU doing commercials, Alvina says. Dropped him off myself. I don't know why he doesn't just do them in his studio here. Something about the sound effects, I think he might have said. I'm surprised he didn't tell you that. The bitch of it is Henry did. Cousin Buddy's rib crib. The old ball and chain, beautiful downtown La Riviere, all that. Even told Jack that Alvina Morton was going to drive him. A few things have happened to Jack since that conversation. He's re-encountered his old childhood friend, he's fallen in love with Judy Marshall's twinner, and just by the way, he's been filled in on your basic secret of all existence. But none of that keeps him from turning his left hand into a fist and then slamming himself directly between the eyes with it. Given how fast things are now moving, making this needless detour strikes him as an almost unforgivable lapse. Mrs. Morton is regarding him with wide-eyed alarm. Are you going to be picking him up, Mrs. Morton? No, he's going for a drink with someone from ESPN. Henry said the fellow would bring him back afterward. She lowers her voice to the timber of confidentiality at which secrets are somehow best communicated. Henry didn't come right out and say so, but I think there may be big things ahead for George Rathbun. Very big things. Badger Barrage going national? Jack wouldn't be entirely surprised. But he has no time to be delighted for Henry now. He hands Mrs. Morton the cassette tape, mostly so he won't feel this was an entirely wasted trip. Leave this for him where... He stops. Mrs. Morton is looking at him with knowing amusement. Where he'll be sure to see it is what Jack almost said. Another mental miscue. Big city detective indeed. I'll leave it by the soundboard in his studio, she says. He'll find it there. Jack, maybe it's none of my business, but you don't look all right. You're very pale, and I'd swear you've lost 10 pounds since last week. Also, she looks a bit embarrassed, your shoes are on the wrong feet.
So they are. He makes the necessary change, standing first on one foot and then the other. It's been a tough 48 hours, but I'm hanging in there, Mrs. M.
It's the fisherman business, isn't it?
He nods. And I have to go. The fat, as they say, is in the fire. He turns, reconsiders, turns back. Leave him a message on the kitchen tape recorder, would you? Tell him to call me on my cell just as soon as he gets in. Then, one thought leading to another, he points to the unmarked cassette tape in her hand. Don't play that, all right? Mrs. Morton looks shocked.
I'd never do such a thing. It would be like opening someone else's mail.
Jack nods and gives her a scrap of a smile. Good.
Is it him on the tape? Is it the fisherman?
Yes, Jack says, it's him. And there are worse things waiting, he thinks but doesn't say. Worse things by far. He hurries back to his truck, not quite running. 20 minutes later, Jack parks in front of the baby shit brown two-story at 1 Nail House Row. Nail House Row and the dirty snarl of streets around it strike him as unnaturally silent under the sun of this hot summer afternoon. A mongrel dog, it is in fact the old fellow we saw in the doorway of the Nelson Hotel just last night, goes limping across the intersection of Ames and County Road OO, but that's about the extent of the traffic. Jack has an unpleasant vision of the walrus and the carpenter toddling along the east bank of the Mississippi with the hypnotized residents of Nail House Row following along behind them, toddling along toward the fire and the cooking pot. He takes 2 or 3 deep breaths, trying to steady himself. Not far out of town, close to the road leading to Ed's Eats, in fact, that nasty buzzing in his head peaked, turning into something like a dark scream. For a few moments there, it was so strong, Jack wondered if he was perhaps going to drive right off the road, and he slowed the Ram to 40. Then, blessedly, it began to move around toward the back of his head and fade. He didn't see the no trespassing sign that marks the overgrown road leading to Black House. Didn't even look for it, but he knew it was there. The question is whether or not he'll be able to approach it when the time comes without simply exploding. Come on, he tells himself, no time for this shit. He gets out of the truck and starts up the cracked cement walk. There's a fading hopscotch diagram there, and Jack swerves to avoid it without even thinking, knowing it's one of the few remaining artifacts which testify that a little person named Amy St. Pierre once briefly trod the boards of existence. The porch steps are dry and splintery. He's vilely thirsty and thinks, man, I'd kill for a glass of water. Or a nice cold, the door flies open, cracking against the side of the house like a pistol shot in the sunny silence, and Beezer comes running out. Christ almighty, I didn't think you were ever going to get here. Looking into Beezer's alarmed, agonized eyes, Jack realizes that he will never tell this guy that he might be able to find Black House without Mouse's help. That thanks to his time in the territories, he has a kind of rangefinder in his head. No, not even if they live the rest of their lives as close friends, the kind who usually tell each other everything. The Bees has suffered like Job, and he doesn't need to find out that his friend's agony may have been in vain. Is he still alive, Beezer? By an inch, maybe an inch and a quarter. It's just me and Doc and Bear Girl now. Sonny and Kaiser Bill got scared, ran off like a couple of whipped dogs. March your boots in here, sunshine. Not that Beezer gives Jack any choice. He grabs him by the shoulder and hauls him into the little two-story on Nail House Row like luggage. Chapter 23.
One more, says the guy from ESPN.
It sounds more like an order than a request. And although Henry can't see the fellow, he knows this particular homeboy never played a sport in his life, pro or otherwise. He has the lardy, slightly oily aroma of someone who has been overweight almost from the jump. Sports is perhaps his compensation, with the power to still memories of clothes bought in the husky section at Sears, and all those childhood rhymes like fatty, fatty, 2x4, had to do it on the floor, couldn't get through the bathroom door.
His name is Penniman. Just like Little Richard, he told Henry when they shook hands at the radio station. Famous rock and roller from back in the 50s? Maybe you remember him.
Vaguely, Henry said, as if he hadn't at one time owned every single Little Richard had ever put out.
I believe he was one of the founding fathers, Penniman laughed uproariously, and in that laugh Henry glimpsed a possible future for himself. But was it a future he wanted? People laughed at Howard Stern, too, and Howard Stern was a dork.
One more drink, Penniman repeats now.
They are in the bar of the Oak Tree Inn, where Penniman has tipped the bartender $5 to switch the TV from bowling on ABC to ESPN, even though there's nothing on at this hour of the day except golf tips and bass fishing.
One more drink just to seal the deal.
But they don't have a deal, and Henry isn't sure he wants to make one. Going national with George Rathbun as part of the ESPN radio package should be attractive, and he doesn't have any serious problem with changing the name of the show from Badger Barrage to ESPN Sports Barrage. It would still focus primarily on the central and northern areas of the country. But what? Before he can even get to work on the question, he smells it again. My Sin, the perfume his wife used to wear on certain evenings when she wanted to send a certain signal. Lark was what he used to call her on those certain evenings when the room was dark and they were both blind to everything but scents and textures and each other. Lark.
You know, I think I'm going to pass on that drink, Henry says. Got some work to do at home, but I'm going to think over your offer, and I mean seriously.
Ah, Penniman says, and Henry can tell from certain minute disturbances in the air that the man is shaking a finger beneath his nose. Henry wonders how Penniman would react if Henry suddenly darted his head forward and bit off the offending digit at the second knuckle. If Henry showed him a little coolie country hospitality fisherman style. How loud would Penniman yell? As loud as Little Richard before the instrumental break of Tutti Frutti, perhaps, or not quite as loud as that?
Can't go till I'm ready to take you, Mr. I'm Fat But It No Longer Matters tells him. I'm your ride, you know.
He's on his fourth gimlet, and his words are slightly slurred. My friend, Henry thinks, I'd poke a ferret up my ass before I'd get into a car with you at the wheel.
Actually, I can, Henry says pleasantly.
Nick Avery, the bartender, is having a kick-ass afternoon. The fat guy slipped him $5 to change the TV channel, and the blind guy slipped him $5 to call Skeeter's taxi while the fat guy was in the bathroom making a little room.
Huh?
I said, actually, I can. Bartender?
He's outside, sir, Avery tells him, pulled up 2 minutes ago.
There is a hefty creak as Penniman turns on his bar stool. Henry can't see the man's frown as he takes in the taxi, now idling in the hotel turnaround, but he can sense it.
Listen, Henry, Penniman says, I think you may lack a certain understanding of your current situation. There are stars in the firmament of sports radio. Damn right there are. People like the fabulous Sports Babe and Tony Kornheiser make 6 figures a year just in speaking fees. 6 figures easy. But you ain't there yet. That door is currently closed to you. But I, my friend, am one hell of a doorman. The upshot is that if I say we ought to have one more drink, then bartender, Henry says quietly, then shakes his head.
I can't just call you bartender. It might work for Humphrey Bogart, but it doesn't work for me. What's your name?
Nick Avery, sir.
The last word comes out automatically, but Avery never would have used it when speaking to the other one, never in a million years. Both guys tipped him $5, but the one in the dark glasses is the gent. It's got nothing to do with him being blind, it's just something he is.
Nick, who else is at the bar?
Avery looks around. In one of the back booths, two men are drinking beer. In the hall, a bellman is on the phone. At the bar itself, no one at all except for these two guys. One slim, cool, and blind, the other fat, sweaty, and starting to be pissed off.
No one, sir.
There's not a lady? Lark, he's almost said. There's not a lark.
Nope.
Listen here, Penniman says, and Henry thinks he's never heard anyone so unlike Little Richard Penniman in his entire life. This guy is whiter than Moby Dick, and probably about the same size.
We've got a lot more to discuss here.
A lot more to discuss is how it comes out. Unless, that is, unless you're trying to let me know you're not interested.
Never in a million years, Penniman's voice says to Henry Layden's educated ears. We're talking about putting a money machine in your living room, sweetheart, your very own private ATM, and there ain't no way in hell you're going to turn that down.
Nick, you don't smell perfume. Something very light and old-fashioned, my sin, perhaps.
A flabby hand falls on Henry's shoulder like a hot water bottle.
The sin, oh buddy, would be for you to refuse to have another drink with me.
Even a blind man could see the suggest you get your hand off him, Avery says. And perhaps Penniman's ears aren't entirely deaf to nuance, because the hand leaves Henry's shoulder at once. Then another hand comes in its place, higher up. It touches the back of Henry's neck, in a cold caress that's there and then gone. Henry draws in breath. The smell of perfume comes with it. Usually scents fade after a period of exposure, as the receptors that caught them temporarily deaden. Not this time, though. Not this smell.
No perfume, Henry almost pleads.
The touch of her hand on his neck he can dismiss as a tactile hallucination. But his nose never betrays him. Never until now, anyway.
I'm sorry, Avery says. I can smell beer, peanuts, this man's gin, and his aftershave.
Henry nods. The lights above the back bar slide across the dark lenses of his shades as he slips gracefully off his stool.
I think you want another drink, my friend, Penniman says, in what he no doubt believes to be a tone of polite menace. One more drink just to celebrate, and then I'll take you home in my Lexus.
Henry smells his wife's perfume. He's sure of it, and he seemed to feel the touch of his wife's hand on the back of his neck. Yet suddenly it's skinny little Morris Rosen he finds himself thinking about. Morris, who wanted him to listen to Where Did Our Love Go as done by Dirty Sperm. And, of course, for Henry to play it in his Wisconsin rat persona. Morris Rosen, who has more integrity in one of his nail-chewed little fingers than this bozo has got in his entire body. He puts a hand on Penniman's forearm. He smiles into Penniman's unseen face and feels the muscles beneath his palm relax. Penniman has decided he's going to get his way again.
You take my drink, Henry says pleasantly. Add it to your drink. And then stick them both up your fat and be-pimpled ass. If you need something to hold them in place, why, you can stick your job up there right after them.
Henry turns and walks briskly toward the door, orienting himself with his usual neat precision and holding one hand out in front of him as an insurance policy. Nick Avery has broken into spontaneous applause, but Henry barely hears this, and Penniman he has already dismissed from his mind. What occupies him is the smell of my sin perfume. It fades a little as he steps out into the afternoon heat. But is that not an amorous sigh he hears beside his left ear? The sort of sigh his wife sometimes made just before falling asleep after love. His Rhoda. His Lark.
Hello, the taxi? He calls from the curb beneath the awning.
Right here, buddy. What are you, blind?
As a bat. Henry agrees, and walks toward the sound of the voice. He'll go home, he'll put his feet up, he'll have a glass of tea, and then he'll listen to the damn 911 tape. That as-yet-unperformed chore may be what's causing his current case of the heebie-jeebies and shaky shivers, knowing that he must sit in darkness and listen to the voice of a child-killing cannibal. Surely that must be it, because there's no reason to be afraid of his Lark, is there? If she were to return and haunt him, she would surely haunt with love, wouldn't she?
Yes, he thinks, and lowers himself into the taxi's stifling back seat.
Where to, buddy?
Norway Valley Road, Henry says. It's a white house with blue trim standing back from the road. You'll see it not long after you cross the creek. Henry settles back in the seat and turns his troubled face toward the open window. French Landing feels strange to him today. Fraught. Like something that has slipped and slipped until it is now on the verge of simply falling off the table and smashing to pieces on the floor. Say that she has come back. Say that she has. If it's love she's come with, why does the smell of her perfume make me so uneasy, so almost revolted? And why was her touch, her imagined touch, he assures himself, so unpleasant?
Why was her touch so cold? After the dazzle of the day, the living room of Beezer's crib is so dark that at first Jack can't make out anything. Then, when his eyes adjust a little, he sees why. Blankets, a double thickness from the look, have been hung over both of the living room windows, and the door to the other downstairs room, almost certainly the kitchen, has been closed. "He can't stand the light," Beezer says. He keeps his voice low so it won't carry across to the far side of the room, where the shape of a man lies on a couch. Another man is kneeling beside him. "Maybe the dog that bit him was rabid," Jack says. He doesn't believe it. Beezer shakes his head decisively. "It isn't a phobic reaction. Doc says it's physiological. Where the light falls on him, his skin starts to melt. You ever hear of anything like that?" "No. And Jack has never smelled anything like the stench in this room, either. There's the buzz of not one, but two table fans, and he can feel the cross-draft, but that stink is too gluey to move. There's the reek of spoiled meat, of gangrene and torn flesh, but Jack has smelled that before. It's the other smell that's getting to him, something like blood and funeral flowers and feces all mixed up together. He makes a gagging noise, can't help it, and Beezer looks at him with a certain impatient sympathy. "Bad, yeah, I know. But it's like the monkey house at the zoo, man. You get used to it after a while." The swing door to the other room opens, and a trim little woman with shoulder-length blonde hair comes through. She's carrying a bowl. When the light strikes the figure lying on the couch, Mouse screams. It's a horribly thick sound, as if the man's lungs have begun to liquefy. Something, maybe smoke, maybe steam, starts to rise up from the skin of his forehead. "Hold on, Mouse," the kneeling man says. It's Doc. Before the kitchen door swings all the way shut again, Jack is able to read what's pasted to his battered black bag. Somewhere in America, there may be another medical man sporting a Steppenwolf Rules bumper sticker on the side of his physician's bag, but probably not in Wisconsin. The woman kneels beside Doc, who takes a cloth from the basin, wrings it out, and places it on Mouse's forehead. Mouse gives a shaky groan and begins to shiver all over. Water runs down his cheeks and into his beard. The beard seems to be coming out in mangy patches. Jack steps forward, telling himself he will get used to the smell. Sure he will. Maybe it's even true. In the meantime, he wishes for a little of the Vicks VapoRub most LAPD homicide detectives carry in their glove compartments as a matter of course. A dab under each nostril would be very welcome right now. There's a sound system, scruffy, and a pair of speakers in the corners of the room, huge, but no television. Stacked wooden crates filled with books line every wall without a door or a window in it, making the space seem even smaller than it is, almost crypt-like. Jack has a touch of claustrophobia in his makeup, and now this circuit warms up, increasing his discomfort. Most of the books seem to deal with religion and philosophy. He sees Descartes, C.S. Lewis, the Bhagavad Gita, Stephen Avery's Tenets of Existence. But there's also a lot of fiction, books on beer making, and, on top of one giant speaker, Albert Goldman's trash tome about Elvis Presley. On the other speaker is a photograph of a young girl with a splendid smile, freckles, and oceans of reddish-blonde hair. Seeing the child who drew the hopscotch grid out front makes Jack Sawyer feel sick with anger and sorrow. Otherworldly beings and causes there may be, but there's also a sick old fuck prowling around who needs to be stopped. He'd do well to remember that. Bear Girl makes a space for Jack in front of the couch, moving gracefully even though she's on her knees and still holding the ball. Jack sees that in it are two more wet cloths and a heap of melting ice cubes. The sight of them makes him thirstier than ever. He takes one and pops it into his mouth. Then he turns his attention to Mouse. A plaid blanket has been pulled up to his neck. His forehead and upper cheeks, the places not covered by his decaying beard, are pasty. His eyes are closed. His lips are drawn back to show teeth of startling whiteness. "Izzy," Jack begins, and then Mouse's eyes open. Whatever Jack meant to ask leaves his head entirely. Around the hazel irises, Mouse's eyes have gone an uneasy, shifting scarlet. It's as if the man is looking into a terrible radioactive sunset. From the inner corners of his eyes, some sort of black scum is oozing. The Book of Philosophical Transformation addresses most current dialectics, Mauss says, speaking mellowly and lucidly. And Machiavelli also speaks to these questions. Jack can almost picture him in a lecture hall, until his teeth begin to chatter, that is.
Mauss, it's Jack Sawyer. No recognition in those weird red and hazel eyes. The black gunk at the corners of them seems to twitch, however, as if it is somehow sentient, listening to him.
It's Hollywood, Beezer murmurs. The cop, remember?
One of Mouse's hands lies on the plaid blanket. Jack takes it and stifles a cry of surprise when it closes over his with amazing strength. It's hot, too, as hot as a biscuit just out of the oven.
Mauss lets out a long, gasping sigh, and the stench is fetid, bad meat, decayed flowers.
He's rotting, Jack thinks, rotting from the inside out. Oh, Christ, help me through this.
Christ may not, but the memory of Sophie might. Jack tries to fix her eyes in his memory, that lovely, level, clear blue gaze.
Listen, Mauss says.
I'm listening.
Mauss seems to gather himself. Beneath the blanket, his body shivers in a loose, uncoordinated way that Jack guesses is next door to a seizure. Somewhere a clock is ticking. Somewhere a dog is barking. A boat hoots on the Mississippi. Other than these sounds, all is silence. Jack can remember only one other such suspension of the world's business in his entire life. And that was when he was in a Beverly Hills hospital waiting for his mother to finish the long business of dying. Somewhere Time Marshall is waiting to be rescued, hoping to be rescued at least. Somewhere there are breakers hard at work trying to destroy the axle upon which all existence spins. Here is only this eternal room with its feeble fans and noxious vapors. Mouse's eyes close, then open again. They fix upon the newcomer, and Jack is suddenly sure some great truth is going to be confided. The ice cube is gone from his mouth. Jack supposes he crunched it up and swallowed it without even realizing, but he doesn't dare take another.
Go on, buddy, Doc says. You get it out, and then I'll load you up with another hypo-a-dope. The good stuff. Maybe you'll sleep.
Mauss pays no heed. His mutating eyes hold Jack's. His hand holds Jack's, tightening still more. Jack can almost feel the bones of his fingers grinding together.
Don't go out and buy top-of-the-line equipment, Mauss says, and sighs out another excruciatingly foul breath from his rotting lungs.
Don't.
Most people give up brewing after a year or two. Even dedicated hobbyists. Making beer is not for pussies.
Jack looks around at Beezer, who looks back impassively.
He's in and out. Be patient. Wait on him.
Mouse's grip tightens yet more, then loosens just as Jack is deciding he can take it no longer.
Get a big pot, Mauss advises him.
His eyes bulge. The reddish shadows come and go, fleeting across the curved landscape of his corneas. And Jack thinks that's its shadow, the shadow of the Crimson King. Mauss has already got 1 foot in its court.
5 gallons at least. You find the best ones are in seafood supply stores. And for a fermentation vessel, plastic water cooler jugs are good. They're lighter than glass, and I'm burning up. Christ bees, I'm burning up!
Fuck this, I'm gonna shoot it to him, Doc says, and snaps open his bag.
Beezer grabs his arm.
Not yet!
Bloody tears begin to slip out of Mouse's eyes. The black goo seems to be forming into tiny tendrils. These reach greedily downward as if trying to catch the moisture and drink it.
fermentation lock and stopper, Mouse whispers. Thomas Merton is shit. Never let anyone tell you different. No real thought there. You have to let the gases escape while keeping dust out. Jerry Garcia wasn't God. Kurt Cobain wasn't God. The perfume he smells is not that of his dead wife. He's caught the eye of the king. Gorg tenabala-ee-lee-lee. The Apopanax is dead. Long live the Apopanax.
Jack leans more deeply into Mouse's smell. Who's smelling perfume? Who's caught the eye of the king?
The mad king, the bad king, the sad king. Ring-a-ding-ding, all hail the king.
Mouse, who's caught the eye of the king? Doc says, I thought you wanted to know about who. Jack has no idea why this seems important to him, but it does. Is it something someone has said to him recently? Was it Dale? Tansy? Was it, God save us, Wendell Green?
Racking cane and hose, Mouse says confidentially. That's what you need when the fermentation's done, and you can't put beer in screw-top bottles.
You, Mouse turns his head away from Jack, nestles it cozily in the hollow of his shoulder, opens his mouth and vomits. Bear Girl screams. The vomit is pus yellow and speckled with moving black bits, like the crud in the corners of Mouse's eyes. It is alive. Beezer leaves the room in a hurry, not quite running, and Jack shades Mouse from the brief glare of kitchen sunlight as best he can. The hand clamped on Jack's loosens a little more. Jack turns to Doc. Do you think he's going? Doc shakes his head. Passed out again. Poor old Mousey ain't getting off that easy. He gives Jack a grim, haunted look. This better be worth it, Mr. Policeman, 'cause if it ain't, I'm gonna replumb your sink. Beezer comes back with a huge bundle of rags, and he's put on a pair of green kitchen gloves. Not speaking, he mops up the pool of vomit between Mouse's shoulder and the backrest of the couch. The black specks have ceased moving, and that's good. To have not seen them moving in the first place would have been even better. The vomit, Jack notices with dismay, has eaten into the couch's worn fabric like acid.
I'm going to pull the blanket down for a second or two, Doc says, and Bear Girl gets up at once, still holding the bowl with the melting ice.
She goes to one of the bookshelves and stands there with her back turned, trembling. Doc, is this something I really need to see? I think maybe it is. I don't think you know what you're dealing with, even now. Doc takes hold of the blanket and eases it out from beneath Mouse's limp hand. Jack sees that more of the black stuff has begun to ooze from beneath the dying man's fingernails. Remember that this happened only a couple of hours ago, Mr. Policeman. He pulls the blanket down. Standing with her back to them, Susan Bear Girl Osgood faces the great works of Western philosophy and begins to cry silently. Jack tries to hold back his scream and cannot. Henry pays off the taxi, goes into his house, takes a deep and soothing breath of the air-conditioned cool. There is a faint aroma, sweet, and he tells himself it's just fresh-cut flowers, one of Mrs. Morton's specialties. He knows better, but wants no more to do with ghosts just now. He is actually feeling better, and he supposes he knows why. It was telling the ESPN guy to take his job and shove it. Nothing more apt to make a fellow's day, especially when the fellow in question is gainfully employed, possessed of 2 credit cards that are nowhere near the max out point, and has a trio of cold iced tea in the fridge. Henry heads kitchenward now, making his way down the hall with one hand held out before him, testing the air for obstacles and displacements. There is no sound but the whisper of the air conditioner, the hum of the fridge, the clack of his heels on the hardwood, and a sigh. An amorous sigh. Henry stands where he is for a moment, then turns cautiously. Is the sweet aroma a little stronger now, especially facing back in this direction, toward the living room and the front door? He thinks yes. And it's not flowers. No sense fooling himself about that. As always, the nose knows. That's the aroma of my sin. Rhoda, he says. And then lower, Lark? No answer. Of course not. He's just having the heebie-jeebies, that's all. Those world-famous shaky shivers. And why not? Because I'm the sheik, baby, Henry says. The sheik, the shake, the shook. No smells. No sexy sighs. And yet, he's haunted by the idea of his wife, back in the living room, standing there in perfumed cerements of the grave, watching him silently as he came in and passed blindly before her. His lark, come back from Noggin Mound Cemetery for a little visit. Maybe to listen to the latest Slobberbone CD. Quit it, he says softly. Quit it, you dope. He goes into his big, well-organized kitchen. On his way through the door, he slaps a button on the panel there without even thinking about it. Mrs. Morton's voice comes from the overhead speaker, which is so high-tech she might almost be in the room. Jack Sawyer was by, and he dropped off another tape he wants you to listen to. He said it was, you know, that man, that bad man. Bad man, right, Henry murmurs, opening the refrigerator and enjoying the blast of cold air. His hand goes unerringly to one of three cans of Kingsland lager stored inside the door. Never mind the iced tea. Both of the tapes are in your studio by the soundboard. Also, Jack wanted you to call him on his cell phone. Mrs. Morton's voice takes on a faintly lecturing tone. If you do speak to him, I hope you tell him to be careful, and be careful yourself. A pause. Also, don't forget to eat supper. It's all ready to go. Second shelf of the fridge on your left. Nag, 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 Henry says, but he's smiling as he opens his beer. He goes to the telephone and dials Jack's number. On the seat of the Dodge Ram, parked in front of One Nail House Row, Jack's cell phone comes to life. This time there's no one in the cab to be annoyed by its tiny but penetrating tweet. The cellular customer you are trying to reach is currently not answering. Please try your call again later. Henry hangs up, goes back to the doorway, and pushes another button on the panel there. The voices that deliver the time and temperature are all versions of his own, but he's programmed a random shuffle pattern into the gadget, so he never knows which one he's going to get. This time it's the Wisconsin rat, screaming crazily into the sunny, air-conditioned silence of his house, which has never felt so far from town as it does today. Times 4:22 p.m. outside, temperatures 82, inside temperatures 70. What the hell do you care? What the hell does anyone care? Chew it up, eat it up, wash it down. It all comes out the same place, right? Henry thumbs the button again, silencing the rat's trademark cry. How did it get late so fast? God, wasn't it just noon? For that matter, wasn't he just young, 20 years old, and so full of spunk it was practically coming out of his ears? What? That sigh comes again, derailing his mostly self-mocking train of thought. A sigh? Really? More likely just the air conditioner's compressor cutting off. He can tell himself that if he wants to.